Filippo Miguel-Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Frood, Vesta Godars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph and Kieran Krug-Meadows and Jose Miranda. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic sustainability May 8th at the Childs Center. Keynote speaker, Stedman Graham. Tickets and information at volunteersofamericaoregon.org. Coming up next is the volunteer-produced KBOO KBOO Evening Newscast. And first, these messages.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland. Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight, hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a victory for Portland airport workers.
An update on the lawsuit filed by Kathleen Hampton against Enzo's Restaurant here in Portland, a lawsuit that has garnered national attention.
Coverage of the National Day of Action in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 8th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. A police shooting in South Carolina is in the national headlines today after the officer was charged with murder. Walter Scott was the 300th person killed by police in the U.S. in 2015. It was only after a cell phone video emerged that Scott was arrested. The video showed the police officer shooting Scott, an unarmed African-American man, in the back 8 times and then planting a taser as evidence near his body. The release of the video and the subsequent charges against Michael Slager, who has now also been fired from his job, raises disturbing questions about corporate media's role in assisting the police in covering up crimes committed by the police against citizens. The video, taken by an anonymous witness and released by the New York Times, was in stark contrast to the false story, apparently from police sources, that had already been reported by local Charleston media in the shooting of 50-year-old Walter Scott. News 2, the NBC affiliate in Charleston, reported on the day of the shooting, without qualifier, that a struggle took place between the officer and Scott, during which Scott was shot. News 2 went so far as to include in their report the claim that Scott, quote, gained control of the taser to use it against the officer, leading to his shooting. Local news reports also repeated the police claim that officers had immediately begun CPR on Mr. Scott after the shooting. The actual video of the shooting reveals not only that Scott was running away from Officer Michael Slager and was a safe distance away when Slager shot him 8 times in the back, but also shows Slager walking over and placing his taser near Scott before handcuffing him as he lay dying on the ground. Only then was a medical attention summoned for Walter Scott, who was later pronounced dead.
With the rise of public videos recording and documenting police activity, questions have come up across the country about the legality of filming the police. In some instances, citizens filming the police have been charged with obstruction. In other cases, people have been detained for probable cause or reasonable suspicion. A new California law will address the filming of police officers on duty. California State Bill No. 411 will protect people who film the police and outlines what is considered obstruction and what is simply an expression of free speech. A Supreme Court ruling in 2014 made it illegal for officers to search a phone without a warrant unless extraordinary circumstances made it necessary. The wave of quality cameras available in today's cell phones have made the documenting of police activity widely available and make it easier for the public to see how police are performing their jobs.
Contract workers at the Portland International Airport who clean the planes, handle the baggage, serve and cook food, and sweep the floors are one step closer to job security, safe conditions, health care, and fair treatment. It took months of protests and demonstrations organized by two labor unions, SEIU Local 49 and Unite Here Local 8. But today, the Port of Portland Commission voted in favor of the PDX Workplace Initiative, which provides some job security and safety for contract workers at the airport. The initiative requires the retention of 80% of workers when a larger contractor, one with over 50 workers, is replaced. Monetary incentives were established for new contractors to hire out of the pool of former employees. News contractors must submit an enforceable plan for maintaining a positive working relationship with their employees. KBOO labor reporter Jamie Partridge spoke with some of the airport workers who packed the commission meeting today.
Jamie Partridge, labor reporter for KBOO News. I'm here talking with Darcy Holmquist, who is connected with Unite Here. So, Darcy, what's going on here today?
Today, the commissioners are going to be voting on the worker initiative report for better relations for the workers, and mostly creating a lot of incentives for the employers to be hiring the current work staff. So, if a concessionaire moves out of the airport, then the new ones coming in will... they'll be able to pull from a pool is one of the, I believe, the things that they are voting on today, and gives the employees incentive to stay here as well as the employers for hiring from that pool. Also creating safer environment for the workers, especially those that work downstairs with all the chemicals and the hard work that they do, throwing bags, pushing the planes out, all of that. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank on what else they're doing today. But it's all within the initiative and just creating a better work environment for the employees, top to bottom. So the ones that work directly with the customers in the terminal to the ones that are working with the customers, flying their luggage and all of that. So
why is this a problem, the retention of workers out here?
Well, I work for Starbucks, and we have 5 locations here at the airport. 4 of those locations are up for bid this next year. So without that, there's a possibility that I could be out of a job in a year. And without having that there, the unknown is very, very scary for a lot of people, especially me. I've got student loans I have to be paying off, rent and all of that, and not knowing if I have a job in a year. Being able to plan my life around that, it's not fun.
Is there anything about labor relations or working conditions or wages in this agreement?
As far as I know, there's nothing about wages. There is for the labor, and that the companies are to remain neutral. One of the things that they are doing is for the new concessionaires to come in, they have to answer a questionnaire. 20% of their score, if the port is going to award them the contract, is based on how they work with their workers. So benefits package, if the workers decide to unionize, how they will handle that, if they have past relations with unions, and if it was a good relation or not. So there is wording in the initiative. We've been working very hard on this, and it's become apparent over the last couple of months that the city of Portland loves this airport and the people that are here. So we appreciate all the support that we've been getting from the community and all of the different labor groups that are here in the area, also across the water over in Vancouver. So it's been very, very uplifting to have all the support in order to get this done.
Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with the Port Commission to express their views, what would they do?
You know, I am actually not sure on that answer, but let's see. You can go to Facebook and search for Our Airport, and that is the SEIU page on the work that they are doing here.
I'm talking with Nick Campbell, who's a worker out here at the airport with Menzies Aviation. What kind of work do you do, Nick?
I'm a lead ramp agent out here. We do the grounds crew contract for Alaska Airlines.
What do you throw the bags around, or do you direct the airplanes, or?
We actually do both. That we load the planes, we direct the planes around, push them out. So that's what we do.
So why are you here at the Port Commission hearing?
I'm here to hopefully be here for the vote on the minimum standards for the worker initiative and things like that.
So what are the standards that you're pushing for that you hope that they will vote on today?
The one I want is the worker retention for if the contract changes and things like that, that, you know, we can keep our jobs and have the security of our jobs.
So Menzies is a contractor?
Yes, Menzies is a contractor.
And when is their contract up? Do you know?
I think we just signed a 5-year contract, but they can still drop it anytime that they want to.
So y'all been working on this for a while. The Port Commission has kind of stalled around for a while. Maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe more. How long have you been involved?
I've been involved almost a year, and I know the port, I think, has been stalling around for about 6 months on it. They finally in the last 2 or 3 months, started working on things on their end.
Is there anything about wages or benefits in this agreement that they're talking about here at the Port Commission?
They're not doing anything on wages and benefits yet. They're saying that they can't touch that, so they're not touching the wages and benefits yet, which I'd like to see, but it's not happening yet.
That was Nick Campbell speaking with KBOO's Jamie Partridge at the Port of Portland Commission hearing today.
The Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission voted last night to allow the Pembina Propane Company to construct a pipeline at the Port of Portland. Last night's vote allowed a change in the zoning of the area in order to allow Pembina to construct a pipeline along a strip of public land in northwest Portland. The zoning change was required because the land in question is a conservation zone. The pipeline would transport liquid propane a short distance from a train yard to the port, where it would be loaded onto ships for export. The commission voted to approve the zone change despite 4 hours of public testimony overwhelmingly opposed to the change. Here's a sample of some of that testimony.
My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh, and I have taught science for Portland Public Schools and also for the Portland Community College GED programs in Spanish and English. If you haven't studied chemistry for a while, I would encourage you to look closely and question some of the statements that have been made by people who would be making money off of this project, but clearly are not concerned with truth in advertising and the truth in science, what we know about chemistry in our atmosphere that is becoming more and more fragile. The U.S. has pledged in global treaties to a 28% reduction in fossil fuel emissions by December. It's April now. We're talking December. How embarrassing for the city of Portland and for a sustainability commission.
Good evening. My name is Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey, and I'm the community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper. I want to first start out by thanking the Planning and Sustainability Commission members and the city of Portland staff for pouring so much time and energy into this project. I don't doubt that Many overtime hours were worked, and I appreciate the prompt and professional, thorough work of dealing with the city staff. So thank you very much. I'm also aware that you're an all-volunteer commission, so your energy into this topic is especially appreciated. Columbia Riverkeeper represents over 8,000 members and supporters, and you've received our detailed comments outlining our opposition to the Pembina Terminal. Now I thought it would be apt to use this testimony time to share a recent story from another all-volunteer commission in our state, the Oregon Transportation Commission. The Oregon Transportation Commission is tasked with making decisions that affect how we move around the state and what we move around the state. And recently, just last month, they rejected a $2 million subsidy to build a coal dock on the Columbia River. Just like the PSC, the Oregon Transportation Commission found itself in the unique position at being at the center of a debate about how small local decisions play a huge role in global climate change. The Oregon Transportation Commission decided to break new ground and enforce Oregon's carbon reductions policies and look at a project historically, holistically, make it not just about the dock. It was a struggle, and they were met with fierce opposition from industry and status quo politicians, but they were also met with support from the community, from the health professionals, and from their peers. They voted to deny that funding earmarked for a dirty coal dock construction on the Columbia River.
I'm Marilee Day. I live in Cully neighborhood, and I'm here to present the recommendation of the Board of Directors for the Cully Neighborhood Association. Cully is very proud to be the most diverse neighborhood in the city of Portland. Actually, it's the most diverse neighborhood in the state of Oregon. We really need employment. We need money for our schools, but we need a very safe environment to live in. We understand the complexities of our neighborhood and the complexities of this decision. We wrote this resolution weighing the risks and the benefits of the project to our neighborhood and to our children's future. Our recommendation is as follows. Whereby the maritime and rail safety information on the impact of a long propane unit trains coming through Portland, I heard they're coming through Cully, possibly, if it's a Union Pacific, which is in the middle of our neighborhood, and large tanker ships carrying millions of gallons of propane from Portland down the Columbia River across our dangerous bar to Asia has not been completed. So we are concerned about two really important studies that have not been done and you haven't heard. We, the board, are the directors of the Cully Association of Neighbors, recommend that you, the commission, and the city of Portland delay the decision to grant this overlay zone amendment until you get this information and you share it with the neighborhoods who would be affected. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Horner. I want to begin by dispelling the myth so skillfully spun here by the Pembina people that propane is a miraculous, clean, school bus powering wonder fuel that somehow appears out of the ground and effortlessly fills tank cars for delivery. Let us be clear. Propane is derived from a filthy, toxic, water-intensive process that is called hydraulic fracturing or fracking. This process is known to release so much methane to the atmosphere that many recent studies have shown that throughout the production cycle for these fracked gases, the greenhouse gas damage exceeds that caused by burning coal and oil. In addition, I think that it should be crystal clear that propane is not the sum total of Pembina's business. Indeed, it is but a small fraction of its revenues, much of which are deeply embedded in the tar sands of Alberta. These are the deposits that NASA climatologist James Hansen called a carbon bomb, which will mean game over for the climate. It seems fantastic to me that this project is even on the table. The evidence of fossil fuel-driven climate change is everywhere. California, the Arctic, the Antarctic, unprecedented glacial retreat everywhere. This industry is no different than the tobacco pushers. The difference this time is that it isn't the poor lives of individual addicts being sacrificed for profit, but the planet itself. It's ironic that the citizen resistance to these climate-busting projects is often called radical or extreme. I think we should look at it a different way. The fossil fuel industry has a business model that is designed to drive the climate over the edge. They are determined to discover, recover, and burn every bit of carbon they can. That cannot be allowed to happen. That is a radical assault on the planet.
Thank you.
And you can expect fierce resistance.
Thank you.
To this project.
Thank you.
That was testimony from last night's hearing of the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission. Despite the hundreds of people who gathered at the hearing and testified against the propane terminal, the commission voted to allow Pembina to move forward with their plan to construct a propane terminal and pipeline at the Port of Portland in an ecologically fragile conservation zone.
Oregon Senate Minority Leader Ted Farrioli has submitted a bill that would allow medical marijuana dispensaries to open their shops to recreational retail when marijuana becomes legal on June 1st. Currently, the state is in the process of creating the rules that will regulate the legal weed market, but those regulations are a long way from being finished, and until they are, retailers cannot make plans. The medical marijuana community has tackled these policies long ago, and now it may be that structure that allows them to temporarily become retail outlets, as there are already testing and security regulations in place.
The Oregon Senate today passed a bill that prevents schools in the state from expelling children who are younger than the sixth grade. Here's a clip from the testimony at today's vote with Senator Sarah Gelser, who introduced the bill.
Thank you, Madam President. Colleagues, Senate Bill 553 is a critical bill that is going to help us address the school-to-prison pipeline. When our kids reach the age of 18, we want them to be graduating from high school and going to work in our communities, not facing a lifetime of incarceration. When Youth Rights and Justice first started to talk to me about this issue, I was surprised. Would you believe that in the 13-14 school year, in grades K through 5, kindergarten through 5th grade, so little kids, there were 8,000 kids who were out of school suspended, sent home from school, not able to attend school. I heard that number and I said, good grief with gravy, we've got to do something about that. 70% of these suspensions, out of school suspensions, were for minor infractions, things deemed as disruptive behavior. When we dug more deeply into the numbers, we saw that it's significantly disproportionate for students who are at risk, students with disabilities and students of color. In the early elementary grades, 1 out of 28 African American students in Oregon will be suspended, out of school suspended from school. That's compared to only 1 out of 100 Caucasian students. And those ratios get even worse by the fifth grade. By the fifth grade, 1 out of every 12 African American students in Oregon will have been out of school suspended, compared to 1 out of 36 Caucasian students. Our numbers don't compare well, for instance, to New York City. New York City suspends students at a rate of 13.73 students per thousand. So remember that number, 13.73, 14. And in Oregon, our number is 83.5 per thousand out of school suspensions for kids grade through 5. In 2011, to put those numbers out there, that's 13,769 out of school suspensions. Some of those are duplicated. Those aren't individual kids. Some kids are suspended more than once. So 13,000 in New York City. In Oregon, 46,899 out of school suspensions of little kids in 2011. 5% of white students will be suspended out of school at some point in their school career, while 16% of black students. And this was another one that surprised me. African American girls are suspended at a rate 12% higher than girls of any other color and than most boys. So we have a significant problem here. When kids are not in school, they can't learn. When they fall behind because they aren't receiving the instruction they need, it makes it even more difficult for them to be ready to earn their high school diplomas, and it makes it more likely that they are going to be disruptive in school because school becomes more difficult. When we're talking about little kids, kindergartners through fifth graders, little kids can be disruptive. I've lived with little kids. You've probably lived with little kids. That's just what it's like to live with little kids. Senate Bill 553 deals with this issue by saying we will no longer in Oregon suspend children in grades K through 5 unless they are presenting a significant risk to themselves or others in the school or are making a threat against the school. This will still allow districts to address health and safety issues, but it will mean that districts do a better job of meeting the behavioral needs of students and keep the focus on keeping kids in school where they can learn so that they can be prepared to graduate from high school. Colleagues, Senate Bill 553 is a critical bill that will help us meet our 40-40-20 goals. It will help us address some racial equity issues and disability equity issues, and it will make sure that more of our kids are graduating from high school and less of our kids are winding up in the correction system.
That was Oregon State Senator Sarah Gelzer speaking today on the Senate floor. The bill to stop the expulsion of children in kindergarten through fifth grade passed the Senate and now heads to Governor Kate Brown's desk for approval.
The Senate also passed a bill aimed at stopping so-called revenge porn. The bill, SB 377, modifies the computer crime statute to specifically include theft of an intimate image as prohibited conduct. Here's some of the testimony on the bill by Oregon Senator Mark Haas from Beaverton.
The purpose of this bill before you today is to close a harmful gap that exists in our current law. The times we live in, we're finding the need to update our laws with the ever-changing technological landscape. This bill modifies Oregon's computer crime statute, which already makes it a Class C felony for using a computer for the purpose of theft. Senate Bill 377 adds clarity to the existing statute by adding theft of an intimate image. We didn't anticipate ever putting into our lexicon phrases such as revenge porn. We didn't anticipate that someone could steal a private image from another person's device. Sitting to my right here at my desk is my legislative assistant, Christina Gordon. I'm very proud of her because she came forward. This is an issue she unfortunately knows all too well and shows that this can happen to anyone we know. This can happen to your friends, your daughters, your legislative assistants. And it's not just in Oregon. Remember those news stories of the female celebrities whose images were stolen from their computers and phones? This is what we're talking about. Problem is when victims go to law enforcement, they often run into a dead end. Currently, stealing an intimate image from an electronic device is not illegal. But it should be, and this bill closes the gap. Charges of theft usually incur when there's a loss of a monetary value. But a person's privacy, what's that worth? It has no monetary value because it's priceless. This is common sense legislation, unfortunately, to meet the times we live in. We need to send a message that this won't be tolerated any longer, and I urge your support.
A similar bill passed the Oregon House last week. That bill put a ban on revenge porn, as well as banning the practice of taking pictures under the skirts of girls and women in public places. The so-called upskirting bill followed a ruling in Washington County that a 61-year-old man who took pictures of the skirt of a 13-year-old girl violated no law. The bill passed by the Oregon House clarifies that upskirting is illegal whether or not the victim is wearing underwear.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with station manager Mike Crenshaw, followed by Right to Survive Radio on at 6. On tonight's show, Right to Survive travels to Tucson, Arizona. Listeners will hear of the challenges, services, and laws that prohibit the unhoused from having a dignified quality to their lives. We'll also hear about the outcome of a federal court decision affecting local law. And the next steps people of Safe Park, Tucson, Arizona, are taking to continue fighting for equality and belonging. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be warm and sunny, with temperatures in the mid-60s following mild overnight lows. Today in history, in 1937, journalist Seymour Hersh was born in Chicago. Hersh is most famous for his piece in the New Yorker magazine exposing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Hersh went on to expose abuses by the American military at Abu Ghraib. Our quote of the day is also from Seymour Hersh in a 2007 article entitled The Redirection, describing the George W. Bush administration's Iraq policy. He said, a byproduct of these activities has been the bolstering of Sunni extremist groups that espouse a militant vision of Islam and are hostile to America and sympathetic to Al-Qaeda.
It's 5:29, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Street arrogance seems to be accelerating even faster than our infinite cosmos is expanding. It's not enough that the greed and illegal acts of giant financial conglomerates crashed our economy. Not enough that they demanded and got a full taxpayer bailout. Not enough that no Wall Street executives went to jail for their frauds. Not enough that they prevented any restructuring of their too-big-to-fail financial oligarchy. And not enough that they've gone right back to their profiteering casino scams that are setting us up for another crash. Now, consumed by conceit, they're demanding our respect. In fact, the spoiled barons of the street are presently throwing a petty political tantrum, screaming that some U.S. senators are not being sufficiently friendly and deferential to them. Thus, executives from Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs have been insisting that such senators as Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown be more respectful and soften their tone toward Wall Street. To put some swat in their snit, the bankers are threatening to withhold campaign donations to the Dems. Citigroup has already held back its annual donation to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, expressing concern that Senator Warren might be given more power. Yes, Wall Street's gaseous ego is so inflated that it feels entitled to dictate the assignments and power that a U.S. senator can have. Likewise, Reuters reports that J.P. Morgan was so upset that it met with Democratic Party officials to stress that its campaign donations are dependent on, quote, a friendlier attitude toward the banks. This is Jim Hightower saying, dear Wall Street, imagine how upset we the people are that you're upset. Get a grip. Trying to buy respect only diminishes what you have, and you don't have a dime's worth to spare.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A local restaurant received A local restaurant received global attention after they refused to serve a woman on Valentine's Day, and now a settlement has been reached in the lawsuit that followed. On Valentine's Day of this year, Enzo's Cafe Italiano was hosting a special nine-course Valentine's Day meal. Kathleen Hampton had a reservation with her husband, but showed up alone when her husband decided that he was not hungry. Enzo's said in a previous statement that due to the demand on Valentine's Day, they would not seat single visitors at tables, but rather directed them to the bar. Kathleen Hampton contended that they refused to take her order and told her to leave. While it's unclear whether she was asked to sit at the bar, the settlement requires that neither Kathleen Hampton nor the restaurant discuss the suit. Unnamed sources inform us that the settlement sought by Ms. Hampton includes sitting down to talk things out. Sources further inform us that the request was met and that Ms. Hampton and the owner of Enzo's have since become friends.
Low levels of the radioactive isotope cesium-134, which researchers say could only have come from Fukushima, were found in waters collected on February 19th in British Columbia. This is the first time that contaminated water from the Fukushima reactor has been found on North American shores. The level of radiation in the sample is low enough to have no impact, being more than 1,000 times lower than the standard for drinking water.
Jurors in the Boston bombing trial of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev have returned a guilty verdict on all 30 charges stemming from the April 2013 attack at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Of the 30 counts, 17 of them carry a possible penalty of the death sentence. At no time has Tsarnaev ever claimed innocence, but rather took the defense that his brother had radicalized him and that he was along for the ride. Jurors deliberated for 2 days, stopping once to ask the judge to clarify the definition of aiding and abetting and conspiracy. The second stage of the case will decide how Tsarnaev will be punished now that he has been found guilty on all 30 counts.
While Greece maintains it is not seeking financial assistance from Russia, Prime Minister Tsipras began talks Tuesday with President Putin in Moscow. This occurs one day before Greece is scheduled to make a £333 million payment to the International Monetary Fund. Moscow sees Greece as a potential ally within the European Union and a possible partner for undermining European consensus regarding the censure of Russian actions in the Ukraine.
The Kenyan government is facing criticism for its slow response to a massacre of mainly Christian students at Garissa University last week. A total of 148 students were killed when gunmen from Al-Shabaab stormed the university. Kenya has, for the last 3 days, launched airstrikes against Al-Shabaab at their bases in Somalia. But some analysts say that Kenya's response is similar to its past attacks in Somalia that helped stoke the flames of unrest that ultimately led to the creation of Al-Shabaab. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Professor Abdi Ismail Samatar, a political analyst who focuses on this region of Africa.
We've all heard about the horrific massacre of students at the university in Kenya last week, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the connections between Al-Shabaab, that massacre, and the situation in Somalia.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I think it's important to understand that Al-Shabaab, over the last 7 years, have turned to from what was a nationalist project of trying to drive the Ethiopian occupiers of Somalia to a terrorist organization that is as ruthless as they get. The killing of innocent students on the basis of the claim that they were Christians occupying a Muslim land is betrayed by the fact that they kill Muslims in mosques every day in Somalia itself. So this is a group who really have, whose only project is to come to power in Somalia and will use any pretext to torture and maim and kill and rape people across the board. I think that's a fact that needs to be known. It's also important for our audience to know that the Kenyan government, not only has it been sleeping on the switch because this is the second major massacre of its kind in 2 years, 2013 in September, a shopping mall by the name Westgate in central Nairobi was attacked by Al-Shabaab, in which they demolished the place and killed 67 people. And so one would expect the Kenyan government and its security forces to be alert to issues of this kind. The final thing I would like to add is that Kenya occupies, has become an occupying power of parties of the so-called Somali Republic in Somalia. And it had its troops there for now about 3-4 years. And the claim is that it's trying to help the Somali government reorganize its authority and run its own country, when in fact it's supporting warlords. And it uses that territory in Somalia as a buffer, not only as a buffer zone, but as a leverage point to have the Somali government do what the Kenyan government wants it to do. And Shabaab has been using that as a justification for its attacks on Kenya. That's the relationship the public needs to be aware of.
And what was the justification given by the U.S. government to work with Ethiopia to go after the Union of Islamic Courts and overthrow them? Was it simply that it was an Islamic government, or were there other justifications given?
You see, there is a part of our population in the United States, Rand Paul, who declared his presidential candidacy yesterday in Kentucky, is of the opinion that, you know, we have to draw a line with the Muslims. So the Muslims become one category, homogenizes everybody. President Bush, who was much more sophisticated than Rand Paul, nonetheless bought into that project that there is a possibility these people will become terrorists. And because of our bad intelligence and our inability to make a careful judgment when that was necessary, made us sleepwalk into a trap which the Ethiopians set for us, and hence the consequences that has happened. So it was really a thoughtless decision on the part of the decision makers in our country to label these as terrorists, destroy the peace which they have created. And the consequence of that has been over 300,000 people were killed in the process, either by the Ethiopians or by the famine that followed that war.
I've been speaking with Professor Abdi Samatar from the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the recent massacre of students at Garissa University in Kenya, some of the origins of Al-Shabaab and the U.S. role in Somalia and how that led to the creation of Al-Shabaab. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 8, 2015. Israeli troops shoot and kill a Palestinian man, and settlers uproot trees owned by Palestinian farmers. These stories and more, coming up, stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Wednesday morning a young Palestinian man north of the central West Bank city of Ramallah, allegedly after he stabbed two soldiers, causing serious wounds to one of them. Israeli sources said that the attack took place close to Ma'ali Livona settlement and that the Palestinian is from Sinjal, nearby village. The wounded soldiers received treatment by Israeli medics and were moved to the Sha'aret Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem. Shortly after the attack, the Israeli army invaded several Palestinian towns in Ramallah, including Sinjal, Turmus Ayya, and the Al-Lubban al-Sharqiya, and detained seven young Palestinians. The soldiers asked the seven to identify the slain Palestinian, since he did not carry an ID card, but they could not identify him. They said the Palestinian was shot in the head, and next to him was a clean knife that did not carry any trace of blood. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded Beit Umar town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron and kidnapped two former political prisoners. Moreover, a Palestinian man was kidnapped on Tuesday night in Hebron city, and a young man from Jenin was kidnapped from his work site in Haifa. Also on Wednesday, a group of Israeli extremists invaded Palestinian olive orchards in the Al-Jab'a village near the West Bank city of Bethlehem for the fifth time in a row and cut more than 150 olive trees belonging to the villagers. Local residents said that they depend on their orchards as their main source of livelihood. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 8, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Rishmawi and me, Iman Abdrabo Banoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron, Jimmy Tardy, Galen Sanford, and Tarina Aguilar. Special thanks to Chris Andre. Our engineer tonight is Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503 423-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Jean DeMaster, Executive Director of Human Solutions, about the extension of the winter shelter. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, host Sarika Mehta speaks with Cece Bell about El Defo, her memoir graphic novel. In her book, Bell chronicles her hearing loss at a young age and her subsequent experiences with the phonic ear, a very powerful and very awkward hearing aid. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
It's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
It's Wednesday. It's 5:45, and that means it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest here at KBOO and in the greater KBOO community. We are joined once again by Mike Crenshaw, station co-manager, and Mike has brought with him tonight Joyce Harris, who is here to discuss a really interesting event coming up next Monday evening, brought to you by the African American Alliance of Portland and the YWCA of Greater Portland. Joyce, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you for having me.
Mike?
I'm doing good, Brian. Hey, Aaron. Good to be here. Good to have Joyce here. I'm excited about this event, empowering our youth, an evening with